Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. And Andrea Haines is here, the editor for Blue Sky Innovation. We'll kick some stories around with her a little bit later in the program. Actually, coming up, I don't have my notes in front of me, but next week is the, I want to get it right here, the Islamic Food and Nutrition Council sponsoring the International Halal Food Conference. What? The Halal Food Conference. Actually, it is a growing business. You know, we talk about the restaurants and the idea of certifying halal food. We'll talk about that. That's an issue that will be addressed next week. Of course, it's a business show, and it is still this week, so United Airlines is compulsory. We'll touch on the airlines a little bit later as well. But Andrea is in here. And, you know, you guys at Blue Sky broke a little bit of news in the past hour as well. It comes about Groupon. It seems like Groupon is sort of our barometer in this city, and a little bad news coming from them.
Yes. So Groupon did some layoffs this week, and we understand it was about 100 people in Chicago laid off basically at the Groupon headquarters.
So all 100 were in Chicago?
You know, they wouldn't say all. They said most. Okay. So, you know.
And what did they do? Any idea?
You know, there was a bigger batch, I think. 30 of them were from the editorial group, so the kind of editorial content creation group.
I read that. So what is editorial creation? What does that mean?
They do a lot of chatter. They do a lot of, you know, description around the deals, all that kind of stuff. Okay. And their business is shifting a little bit. So they say they're, you know, streamlining, right? That's the corporate word.
Right. No one wants to hear streamlining on a Friday afternoon.
Exactly.
And so how are they doing in general, Groupon?
So, you know, they've had their ups and downs. I mean, of course, on the whole, from when they IPO'd, they're down, down, down. I mean, they kind of call 2016 a rebuilding year where they're kind of refocusing their business. They have been sort of tightening up globally and trying to refocus. So, you know, they're trying to look in some new directions.
And also there was in the piece you referred to Living Social. I get emails from Living Social. It's one of my automatic deletes. I just don't pay attention to those things. But that's a company that they bought last year. And
yep.
It's not surprising, or we knew that they were going to eliminate all those workers, correct?
Right. So they're also eliminating those 95 workers from that company they acquired, which back in the day was a big competitor of theirs when it was, you know, the sort of post-recession era daily deals. Everybody was trying to get you a deal a day. They were all those kind of deal a day companies.
Right.
Now you've got Living Social goes away, and you've got Groupon kind of pivoting a little bit.
All right. So that's going on with Groupon. So a sorry Easter for some of the people there.
Yes, bad pre-holiday news.
But the fans of Guard Llama will be watching TV tonight?
Yes, so there's a little bit of a brighter spot. This is a personal security device that gives you kind of one-touch communication with law enforcement. So their device is going to be on Shark Tank tonight.
And tell me about Guard Llama. What do they do?
Yeah, so they're a personal security company. They create a device that allows you to literally sort of push a button and communicate directly with law enforcement in the event of an emergency.
And so what are their chances, do you know?
You know,
are you betting
my
on
theory
them,
is always if they're making a lot of noise about being on Shark Tank, that probably means there's good news.
Because they know. They know,
you know,
by
yeah,
now, right?
It's not live, so okay. They would already know the outcome. But yes, they're sworn to secrecy, of course.
Right, except they're telling everyone to watch.
Exactly.
So
there's
really
a viewing
bombs,
party
right.
tonight at 1871. So I personally would not probably host a viewing party if I didn't do well, but you never know. I guess all publicity is good publicity.
Well,
at a
good
point.
Luck for them. I know that they've been in or out of the radio station or something, or we've talked about them.
Yeah,
before,
they've been
maybe.
On the scene. They've been around for a little while, so you probably have talked to them in the studio.
Okay, so being around for a little while and getting it or not getting it, I just love this Burger King story from this week. You know, because people with Alexa or was it Bixby now?
Bixby's coming, although Bixby is speaking Korean at this moment and apparently not speaking English fast enough.
Well, you know, that's
another
happened to
tech
me too.
Story this week.
But, you know, these at-home sort of devices where people accidentally order things or they buy things and they don't know. So then Burger King, the people at Burger King said, hey, we've got a great idea.
Let's activate people's devices with a commercial, right? Like in my house, you activate the dog with your commercial. Certain noises cause the dog to activate. In this case, they're using commercials to pump out a sentence that would theoretically activate your Google Home device and describe to you like a Burger King Wikipedia page. So it effectively like brings the ad inside your house in a little bit of a different way.
So they weren't trying to sell burgers by this.
Trying to sell burgers.
Well,
Steve.
See, I guess that's... that's right. I guess that's true.
That's the bottom line.
But they weren't trying to order burgers.
No,
they were just
true.
trying. They were
okay,
trying to
so
make.
Yeah, that's true. Right. I guess they could have been like, Google Home, send 10 burgers. You need to combine with like a delivery service, right? And then you really got it there.
So they weren't doing that. But what they wanted to do is they wanted the ad to stimulate or stimulate
exactly
this thing then to read the Wikipedia page that would say the Whopper is a really super great thing. You should order it.
Yes. And hilariously, I think about this story is that then you get people tampering with the Wikipedia page so that it says, you know, Burger King contains cyanide and, you know, the whole thing goes a little wacky. Now, then you have to ask yourself, as I do when these advertising situations happen, you know, is that really so bad? Because here we are talking about Burger King, or last week everybody's talking about Pepsi. It's all part of the game, right?
We're talking about Burger King, and I'm picturing that weird King guy in my head, and it's not a pleasant thing.
Yeah, they need to erase him from our minds.
So that's the thing. So people, when this was happening, then people would go, who had access to Wikipedia, would alter the page so weird things were being read.
Yes.
Google wasn't happy about it because they weren't consulted, right?
Google was not consulted and pretty quickly turned it off. So it worked for about 3 hours and Google pulled the plug
okay.
on their end.
Okay, yeah. So one other thing. So let's go back to the people altering the Wikipedia page.
Yes.
You know, and they would say things like Whoppers have cyanide, Whoppers have, let's just say gristle.
Oh,
Whoppers
God.
Have gristle. But then there was this guy, a user named Firmachado123.
You couldn't make this stuff up, could you?
And Firmachado123 would alter it and write really nice things about the Whopper.
And imagine why.
Do we have any idea who this Firmachado guy might be?
So Firmachado would perhaps seem to be Fernando Machado, who is Burger King's Senior Vice President for Global Brand Management. So imagine that.
Oh, it could be an accident, right?
Could be somebody trolling and using that kind of name. You
so
know,
a guy in charge of marketing for Burger King came up with Firmachado 123.
You know,
wouldn't he do better than that?
You've got to wonder. We've got to trace all this, right, and find out the truth, because it's all kind of hilarious, I guess, and it all gets us talking about Burger King. But you do have people who are like, please don't hack my device. Please don't. Let's not go down this road with, you know, commercials shouting at our home devices.
I kind of like it. I mean, I kind of think this is, I mean, talk about using technology in a clever way,
yeah,
even though it backfired on
them. From an advertising perspective, right? Clever attention getting. What more can you ask for?
Okay, so there's that. It's prom season. It's a formal season. My son in college went to his frat's formal, his girlfriend's frat's formal. And, you know, I wore flannels and jeans for my whole time, flannel shirts. But there's a real market for designer clothes. And apparently that's springing now, creating some business opportunities for women who are sitting in closets full of clothes?
Yep. Well, and it's kind of the classic, you know, your friend has something, you borrow something to wear to a wedding, right? It's sort of taking that and putting it online. So this local company that is new called Designer Share, it's kind of a fashion rental service that allows you to connect with people and literally borrow their clothes.
So explain that again. But you rent them, right? You're paying some sort of rent.
Yes, exactly. So if you have an expensive designer dress, maybe you only wear it once or twice, you can put it up on the site for rental. You can list it on the site. And then somebody who needs to borrow that dress for a week, their week-long rentals, can go on there, search. It's, you know, it's more designer-type items. They have Chanel and Burberry and, you know, other more mid-brands like Coach or things like that. But it's higher-end merchandise.
Right, right, right.
So you can go on there, find something, and rent it for a week. And the numbers we crunched on it were $350 gown. You would potentially rent that for maybe $35 for the week.
Now, if I'm wearing a dress, I'm only going to wear my dress. I'm not going to be comfortable sharing dresses with other people.
Then you're not a customer.
Is that an issue for women or not an issue for women?
I think people, you know, it's funny you should say that, because traditionally it's men who have rented tuxes.
Yeah, true.
Where
right.
women had to buy a new gown every time. So this is kind of, I guess, letting women get on the gown bandwagon. And they do have, they work with local delivery service, and they do ensure, of course, that things are dry cleaned in between. So if you're willing to just kind of suck it up for a night and you know, wear a gently used garment, then
well, it makes perfect sense.
It's some serious savings.
And they're saying charge for rent, like what, 10% of what it's worth? Or what
yeah,
you pay
so
for
that's
it.
Where we arrive at sort of $35 if it's a $350 gown. So you're paying that out, plus there's a few dollars fees here and there on top of it. And then as the person who owns the gown, you'd get about $25 of that.
So these guys are operating here in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and they hope
yes.
to expand around even the world, they said.
Yeah, everybody says that, right? How many ultimately do it?
Right.
But yes, they, like everyone, you know, they have bigger ideas, but they're starting in Chicago.
Right.
And since they're doing more of the local, you know, they're not using UPS or whatever. They are kind of a bit of a middleman on the ground.
So you're saying, like, we're in Chicago and we hope to expand one day to Topeka?
That's, you know, they all want to serve a billion people, and they all want to expand globally.
I bet if they did that, Topeka would welcome them.
True.
So these guys, though, are more in business here. The point I'm getting to is that there are sort of smaller, more localized college ventures like this.
They're right? definitely, there are big ones and there are small ones. You know, the really big one that many people have probably heard of is Rent the Runway, which is not peer-to-peer, where you're not borrowing it from another person, but they actually hold stock of these things and we'll get them to you. And that's become pretty popular.
I like, my favorite is, just by name, is Rendezvous.
Yes, that's funny, right? There's definitely some prime puns waiting to happen there.
All right, so there's that. One more thing. There's a machine learning summit coming to Chicago. Is that next week?
Yes, so that's coming up, and that's kind of a new thing. And just sort of interesting to note that it's getting to that point where Chicago's kind of putting itself on the map with people from Google, IBM Watson, Microsoft, all speaking at this event, which is April 19th.
So maybe then we can learn how to order burgers with IBM Watson?
That's what it's all about, right? It's all starting to happen.
Andrea Haynes, the editor of Blue Sky Nation in Chicago. I'm sorry, we're a little just disheveled today. What's in red eye this weekend?
It's a semi-holiday. What can you do?
It's a great red eye this week.
Of course, always say it's a great red eye. You should always pick it up. But this week in particular, we have the brand new patios and rooftop spots. So
perfect.
The minute the weather gets like about 5 degrees warmer, we're all going to be flocking to those places.
It's going to be around 80 degrees tomorrow.
Well, then we're perfect timing because we have a little guide right there.
Blue Sky Innovation. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.
It's 12:22. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much for tuning in on this Friday and Easter just around the corner. Tom Gimbel is in the studio. He is the founder and CEO of the LaSalle Network. Tom, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hello, Steve.
All right. So, you know, no pressure. Andrea Haynes was here and from Blue Sky Innovation.
Well, she's always got a ton of stuff to talk about.
A ton of stuff, but there was something like I was just a little off. I called her Blue Sky Nation or something. So it's, I don't know if it's...
She'd like it to be a Blue Sky Nation, I think. That'd be good
maybe,
for her.
Yeah. So it's up to you to get me back on track. No pressure at all.
Yeah. Well, I think the topic is...
I'm a little freaked out.
It's National Stress Awareness Month.
Right. So I think I'm pretty much aware of stress every month, so I don't know why they would have to pick one.
I think everybody thinks that they're stressed out all the time, right?
Oh, yes. That's a really good question. So everyone says, I don't have time, I can't do this, blah, blah, blah. But there is real stress, and then there's sort of self-created stress. How do you know if you're really in trouble?
I think the real stress is when there's going to be ramifications for it, right? If you don't do the, you know, if you're a lawyer and you're not defending your client the right way,
that's
he's going to go to jail,
right?
If you're going to get if you're a salesperson, you're closing a big deal, and if the deal fails, you're going to lose your job.
You know what? I'm going to disagree with you because I think the real stress, I think you create your own. It does. I think you create.
It doesn't make a difference.
You almost create the consequences. Like if I don't do this, you know, I'm going to fall off a bridge and families will die.
Yeah, I mean, National Stress Awareness should just be copay for mental health at your therapist's office.
Okay, so let's accept the fact that we're all a little stressed out and people are trying to find a job and interview process, which would be an especially stressful situation, I would think.
Yeah, so what most people don't do is they don't prepare for the interview, right? So they look and they say, okay, I'm going to interview at WGN. So I'm going to go on WGN's website. I'm going to Google WGN and know all the gossip and the, are they buying a station or selling a station? And they think that they prepared. But really what an interview is, it's about you. So the interviewer is going to interview you. And I always say to people, when you're going on an interview, don't fail you. You need to know, you need to get an A in Steve,
You know, that's a really good point because I always feel like, and this is what I do, and with this show or whatever, if I have my homework and can read everything, then I'm not stressed. I feel like I'm ready for it. So if I'm going to go interview somewhere, I think if I know everything about those people or a few facts that they might not expect me to know, that I'm prepared for it. And you're right. Then it comes right back at you because they're not asking about themselves. Right.
Steve, tell me about it. So I saw that in 1998 you worked here. Tell me about that. You're oh, God, that was a long time ago. I can't remember.
So I'm like, oh, but I see you went to a Eureka College. Yeah, they don't really care about that.
No, they don't care. They want to, it's great that you can do research, but what do you know about you? Where the instance, so many people fabricate their resumes, right? And not even the standpoint of lying, just a little bit of embellishment.
Sure, right.
But the key is, what did you do? When did you do it? Who did you work for? And to go back and review, who remembers what they did 15 years ago? Go back and look at what's on your resume. You wrote it down. You have to own whatever you write down under your name.
Okay, so you're interviewing someone and you can see that they're really stressed out.
Yep.
How do you react to that?
I think it's normal, right? I mean, this is what I do for a living a lot of the time. So I tell people, let's just relax a little bit. I want people to be relaxed. Actually, if somebody's got a great resume and they bomb an interview, we tell our clients, bring them back.
Really?
Interview. I don't believe it. I believe you can get a second chance to make a first impression. And if somebody fits everything you want on paper and they bomb the interview, we don't know what goes on in people's lives, right? You got a sick kid. You were up all night, this, that, and the other. Now, I know plenty of CEOs and C-levels that go, well, if they can't recover and be on their game, that's
right,
fine.
Move on.
Yeah, that's not who you want to work for.
Okay, so what's more impressive to you, the resume or the interview?
The interview is, well, it's not more impressive. It's what's more important. And I think the interview
guess that's
is...
More, yeah, what makes a bigger impression on you?
The resume gets you into the door, right? But it doesn't cook the meal. It doesn't clean the house, right? You've got to come in and you've got to own that. And you don't have to be able to go toe-to-toe with the C-level person you're interviewing with, but you do need to be able to explain why something's on your resume and what you did.
All right, so do your homework. What's one other quick thing you'd recommend?
The second one is the role play, and most people don't do that, right? And just to practice.
Right, okay. So how do you do that?
Well, there's two ways. I always think the best people I know who perform at a very high level in interviews or in presentations is they can do both sides of the conversation alone.
Right.
So when you're sitting in your car and you're actually saying, so Steve, how did you handle that situation? Well, Tom, you can do that.
Okay, so a different way to put that is, and I think maybe a little hipper
schizophrenia?
Visualize. They always talk about athletes visualizing the moment or the play. And that's kind of what you're talking about, right? Visualize the
See
interview.
Yourself in the interview and do that. And the second one is get somebody to interview you and say, be a real jerk to me. I mean, interview me hard. Don't let me off the hook. And to practice that. Because when you just give your resume to somebody, they go, oh, yeah, this looks really good.
Yeah, right. I like that font. Mm-hmm. Right. All right, Tom Gimbel, the CEO of the LaSalle Network. People can see more at LaSalle Network.
At LaSalleNetwork.com. You can follow us at LaSalle Network on Twitter and at Tom Gimbel.
Thanks for coming by.
Always good to see you.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is 12:36 on the Wintrust Business Lunch right here on 720 WGN. All right, I was saying before the headlines, really, that, I mean, I do think in many ways the United Airlines story has been talked to death, and there's not too much more to say about it. So let's have more to say about it. Mark Scribner is on a phone line. Mark, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hey, thank you for having me.
All right, so you've got to be talking about this as well, I would imagine.
Yeah, quite a bit over the past few days.
Mark Scribner is the senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Okay, and so typically I would resist beating a dead horse, but I read a piece that you wrote, and it really got me thinking about some new things. Here's a line from it. If American consumers wish to enjoy improved service quality in air travel, they should demand that Congress repeal 90 years of anti-competitive federal law. Well, I think the reaction has been really members of Congress to write more regulations. You want them to repeal regulations, including one that goes back to 1926. We were writing airline regulations in 1926?
Well, yeah, that would be the Air Commerce Act of 1926 was the first sort of comprehensive aviation legislation in the U.S., and it did a number of things that are still with us today. One of the things that I raised in my piece was the fact that foreign flag carriers are prohibited in virtually every circumstance from servicing U.S. domestic routes.
Right, and is that what's called cabotage?
Correct. Yeah, that's cabotage, and that term is also used as a similar situation in the maritime shipping industry as well.
All right, so I want to go back to 1926 first. What was it? What was the situation or standing then that would prompt the Congress to write regulations? I mean, I can't imagine there was a lot of air traffic, and certainly not much international air traffic.
Right, and you know, so 1926. This was the infancy of the U.S. aviation industry, and the purpose for that law in 1926 of prohibiting foreign competition along U.S. routes was quite simple. They wanted to protect a nascent industry from competition. Now, you know, moving forward 90 years, I think it's very difficult to argue that the U.S. aviation industry is nascent. And that the original basis for that 1926 law, if it was even a good idea at the time, has long ago slipped away.
So in 1926, the members of Congress didn't want some British ne'er-do-well like Richard Branson to buy an airline and beat up on the American air traffic.
That's exactly right.
And so that affected the current ne'er-do-well Richard Branson just a few years ago, the owner of Virgin Airways. Explain that for me.
Yeah, so, you know, another provision from the 1926 Act, which was then updated and the restrictions were tightened, in the Civil Aeronautics Act of 1938. But what that did, and we're still left with this additional legacy, it prohibits U.S. flag airlines from being owned by foreigners. The current cap is 25%. So even when Richard Branson was operating Virgin America prior to its sale to Alaska Airlines, which against his express wishes, by the way, he only held 25% of that company. The rest at the time was owned by a New York hedge fund.
All right. So let's talk about this cabotage of these local routes. I lead groups to Europe from time to time. I've got a group I'm leading to Ireland next week, and we always fly Aer Lingus. I love Aer Lingus. I wouldn't mind taking Aer Lingus from Chicago to, say, Atlanta one day or to Denver. I didn't realize until you wrote it and then I kind of thought about it that Aer Lingus can't legally fly those routes. And you'd like to see that change. What would happen if that could change?
Well, you know, what we have in the European Union, you have much more liberal cabotage rights there. So a foreign flag carrier can land at one airport in a foreign country and then take off, or take off from one airport in a foreign country and then land in another in the same country. I think if we were to get rid of the prohibition on cabotage in the United States, I think you would see a lot more competitive pressures on U.S. airlines. And I think as we see, whenever markets are liberalized, when we have more competition, I think we'd see improved quality of service and lower prices. I don't think the airline industry is unique in the respect to that fact, the fact that more competition generally benefits consumers.
Tell me as well about ownership, right? Because aren't there airports in Europe that are privately owned as opposed to here where everything's pretty much publicly owned?
Correct. Europe and Asia, they're much further ahead of the U.S. In terms of privatizing airports, and I think many of those countries have done a great job with that. And that brings up another issue. I think, you know, members of Congress, some have called for more regulation of airline industry practices. I think that's exactly the wrong approach. But there are certain competitive issues, and some of those do have to do with gate access right at airports.
We're sitting here. I'm in Chicago, Mark, and you know, not too far from O'Hare Airport, where American and United, you know, they contribute. They help pay for the expansion, the upkeep of the airport. In exchange, they've got great control over gate access. Those are the sorts of things that you know, allow them to have a hold on the airport, keep the competition down. That's, I'm assuming, the sort of thing that right. You would like to see go away.
Yeah, and one way to address this would be another change in policy, would be another liberalizing policy, and that would be uncapping what is known as the passenger facility charge, which is currently capped at $4.50 per enplanement, and airports charge that per passenger, and that directly, it's a local user fee that's regulated by the federal government, but those funds can then be used to go directly back into the airport. As you said, because the airports, due to federal restrictions, often have a very difficult time of self-financing improvements, they often have to turn to their airline customers. And then in exchange for those the funds from the airlines, the airlines often demand long-term exclusive use gate leases, which they then use to keep out lower-cost competitors, for instance.
I apologize to you, Mark. But so are you saying then if the airports were privately owned, they could get private capital, not rely on government raising money, and then be freer to do what they needed to do?
Yeah, and I don't, you know, I would like to see more privatization experiments at airports in the United States, much as, you know, the similar situations we've seen internationally. But I think even short of that, doing things that allow airports, even if they are going to be controlled by a government airport authority, to behave more like private businesses. And that really allows them, really means allowing them to self-fund, to self-finance. And right now, due to federal restrictions, that's very difficult.
Isn't there a move in the Congress to separate the flight controllers from the federal government? And if I'm correct in that, what do you feel about that?
So, yeah, there was last year there was a proposal from House Transportation Infrastructure Committee Chairman Bill Schuster that would have spun off the FAA's air traffic organization into an independent nonprofit, government chartered nonprofit, very similar to what was done in Canada 20 years ago. And that has allowed Canada to emerge, NAV Canada there, to emerge as the leading air navigation service provider in the world. They're doing a much more technologically advanced things. They were doing that years ago, and the FAA, many of the things that were done, the FAA under the current system is talking about not even getting to some of those upgrades for another decade, perhaps. So I think that, yes, moving toward a major structural reform of air traffic control along the lines of NAV Canada, I think would be a great thing that would allow us to more rapidly upgrade our aging facilities to harness new technologies. And that means that we can take advantage of those and gain some real efficiencies. You know, right now I think we're at the edge of a capacity crunch in air traffic. We have some certain areas, particularly in the New York airspace, where you see real problems there. But we're going to see that ripple across the country if we don't upgrade our air traffic control system. So I think that that would greatly benefit flyers in terms of both having more direct flights. They wouldn't have to fly in these archaic predetermined flight paths that could fly direct. And that also means travelers could expect fewer delays and cancellations due to air traffic.
All right, we've got 30 seconds. One more, though. Something I read from you that I had not understood or seen before. Norwegian Airlines, Norway Air, tried to begin international travel to and from the U.S. I think you wrote for like under $100, and pressure from other airlines stopped them. What's that about?
So Norwegian Air International was actually finally granted approval to enter the United States. And yes, and they plan to offer these very low transatlantic fares. But the latest battle between the U.S. carriers, including United, has been trying to stop some of the Middle Eastern carriers from entering the market.
Because they say they get too much subsidy from their government. Is that true?
It's not true. Really, when you look at what the subsidy figures they're talking about, well, because the United Arab Emirates has built new airports in recent years, that those are somehow subsidies. And what I would say to the carriers and their unions is that, well, who do you think owns and who paid for the airports in the United States? Well, it's the government. So are we all subsidized as well? But the truth of the matter is that the subsidies, if they exist, are not illegal under the Open Skies Agreement. And I think really this is just a distraction and really a naked protectionist ploy on the part of the major U.S. carriers.
Who wants those people in, Mark? I'm sure those airlines have very low consumer satisfaction numbers.
Well, in fact, those Gulf carriers are the are the top-ranked airlines in the world in terms of customer satisfaction.
Let's open our arms and bring them in. Mark Scribner, Senior Fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Great to talk to you today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
You bet. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Jill Egan. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, speaking of lunch, revenue from halal certified food and drinks expected to be about $415 billion. That was the estimate for 2015, and it is only going up. So next week, there's a conference in Chicago, the International Halal Food Conference. What's that about? Well, to find out, we turn to Asma Ahad. She joins us now on a phone line from the Islamic Food and Nutrition Council of America, right here in Chicago, right? Asma, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve, for having me.
Yeah, you're local, aren't you? You're in Chicago.
Yes, we're based out. Our organization is headquartered out of Park Ridge, Illinois, and we're a not-for-profit organization, and our primary service is to provide education and certification regards
to health. So let's talk about this because all right, so my first reaction is like, oh, this is like a kosher certification. Is that a fair thing to say?
It's similar. It is fair to say.
Okay, so but the idea is that the halal certification, you would get a stamp or some sort of certificate of approval that would allow consumers to know that it was certified halal.
Yeah, so you have a lot of products already on the grocery shelf that do have halal certification on there, and a lot of the products are carried at places, mainstream places, like you can even find products at Target and Whole Foods and Jewel, so on and so forth.
All right, so, you know, my first sort of connection with halal, and maybe I'm embarrassed to say this, maybe not, I don't know, were the food trucks and the restaurants. Halal food, I'm thinking, oh, that's kind of Middle Eastern or that's Muslim food. I didn't really associate a religious assignation to the term halal. There is one, though. Tell me, what is halal food?
Halal, literally the word halal is derived from an Arabic word that means permissible, and it's most often used, the term halal is most often used when referring to food that's permissible for Muslims to eat. And when people ask me what is permissible for Muslims to eat, I like to say that everything is halal with the exception of a handful of things. And the most common things that we find in our diet in North America that might make something questionable for Muslims to consume are things that contain alcohol and pork and anything that's cross-contaminated with these items.
So those are the two big things. The idea, though, is you don't know if they're there in traces or if they've been mixed with the ingredients that are eventually used in the food that a Muslim would eat.
Exactly, and that's where certification plays a key role. In a lot of the instances where there's a questionable origin to an ingredient, then we go ahead and do the research and provide the certification.
So my first reaction is, too, are there people who make food, who make their own stamps, and then, boom, just stamp it on their food, say that it is halal certified when maybe it's not really?
There have been several instances of that, but it's getting more regulated. I've seen, you know, a crackdown. There's social medias out there, but from the consumer perspective, and I've also seen from a governmental perspective pushback to say, you know what, if you're not halal and you're not following these basic guidelines, we're going to shut you down.
All right, this is a business show, and I would imagine then there's a chance for growing business opportunities when it comes to providing this certification, right, or this testing. Have you seen that area of growth?
Yeah, I would say in the past 5 years, we've seen an interest in halal grow over 200%, like in terms of just inquiries, people wanting to get certified, people wanting to learn more, people wanting to get educated.
And who are these people who do the certification? Are those the people who are going to be meeting next week?
Yeah, so we have a body of food scientists that specialize in halal certification within our organization that work with food companies to review their ingredient lines, their standard operating procedures, their equipment to make sure there's no cross-contamination, and that's kind of the process we go through. We go through a whole audit process to get products certified.
And I would imagine as well, well, I'm just wondering who goes to you to be certified. I mean, it could be any food at all, right? I mean, anyone who's selling anything who wants to be get the halal certification, it doesn't have to be a traditional Muslim food or anything like that. If you want the certification, for Muslim customers, I would imagine it's your interest to go and get that.
Yes, and you know, just to take a step back to answer your question, previous question fully, our conference is bringing together technical experts from around the world to really address how, as a certifying body, as industry, as governmental bodies, we can all come together to make sure we meet the needs of halal consumers in North America as well as globally. And then to build on that, like you said, halal food is not limited to the food cart, or halal is not limited to the food cart. We actually certify companies like Abbott Nutrition. A lot of the baby formula, you'll see a little crescent M on the bottom. Other products that are certified are Saffron Road products or Organic Valley products. We also certify ingredients. Cargill is one of our key clients, as well as DSM. So all of those companies are looking for halal certification. So it might be in an end product or it might be in an ingredient going into the end product. Everything across the supply chain has to be looked at and certified where it's relevant to be certified.
Asma Ahad from the Islamic Food and Nutrition Council of America. Thanks for joining us today. Hope you have a great event next week.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.